WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at ZBiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's ZBiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is All of It. Hey, Team All of It. If you haven't already heard, it's time to get in our September Get Lit with All of It book club selection. We're reading the number one New York Times bestselling novel, The Vanishing Half by Britt Bennett. The story follows black twin sisters, both very fair-skinned, who were born into a color-struck Southern community. After leaving home, one of the twins decides to pass for white for her whole adult life, not even telling her husband, while the other returns to her Southern community with her darker-skinned daughter in tow. Will these twins' paths ever cross again? You have to read to find out. Entertainment Weekly calls it a story of absolute universal timelessness. We know you're going to love it. To find out how to get your free e-copy courtesy of the New York Public Library, head to wnyc.org/getlit. Then make sure you follow us on Instagram at allofitwnyc, where we host our book club discussions and we'll be talking all things The Vanishing Half. And then mark your calendars for October 1st. Britt will join us for our virtual Get Lit with All of It event that evening, which just so happens to be the one-year anniversary of our very first Get Lit book club event. It's going to be fun. So get reading The Vanishing Half. As long as we're on the subject of books, a new book called Art Curious, a stories of the unexpected, slightly odd, and strangely wonderful art history, makes up for any art history class that caused your eyes to glaze over. Written by Jennifer Dassel, the Associate Curator of Contemporary Art at the North Carolina Museum of Art, the book proves that art history isn't dull at all. It's fascinating and sometimes bizarre, even gory or painful, but not boring. Jennifer, who also hosts a podcast of the same name, joins us now to spin some art history yarn. Jennifer, welcome to All of It.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you write in the introduction of your book that you were not an art lover growing up at all, that you sort of fell into it. If you think about a piece of art, a painting, a sculpture, whatever, what was the first piece that made you think, oh, now I get it?
I think it was probably when I was in high school, and I was taking, of all things, it was a theology course, and there was one specific day where my teacher came in, closed the books, and then closed the blinds, and this was the 90s, so he pulled out a slide carousel. It was nuts. We didn't have PowerPoint. It was nothing high-tech about it, and he pulled out these slides and started talking about the spiritual life of Edvard Munch, the painter, the Norwegian painter of The Scream. I think many of us have that picture of the Scream painting in our brains. And he led us through the background about that painting and about Munch's other paintings and what it meant and what he was going through in his life. And that was one of the first times that art opened up to me as something more than what's on the walls, but it had this bigger story behind it. I still wasn't entirely sold on art at that point. I think it would be a couple more years until I would start really understanding how fun and interesting art could be. But that was that first moment where it was like, oh, okay, there might be something more going on here.
What do you think is the biggest barrier preventing people from engaging with art?
Oh, I think there are a lot of different ones. For sure, the biggest one is that there always is this sense of elitism that has gone hand in hand with art for the longest time, partially because the people who were allowed to purchase art or request that art be made for their institution or so forth usually were people who had a lot of money. So private collectors, big museums, even churches and other religious institutions. And so for many people, that there is that barrier of feeling like it might not be something that's necessarily for them. And then also, to be fair, art, like anything else, has its own language and its own way of understanding it. And so you think that when you're going in at the beginning, beginning that you need to be able to learn this new vocabulary and all these rules and sets of terminology. And that can be also something that can dissuade people from jumping into this world. So that's something that I've always been really concerned about, is just trying to make it more relatable and just more open for a broader audience.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about your book. The name of it is Art Curious: Stories of the Unexpected, Slightly Odd, and Strangely Wonderful Art History. So there are a lot of conspiracies around art, sort of Dan Brown-esque art conspiracy theaters, hidden codes in paintings, confessions, paintings on top of paintings. First of all, is this a symptom of things like the Da Vinci Code, or is there more going on here, this idea that people think there are secrets in art?
I think that's such a good question. And I honestly think it might be a little bit of both, because there are things that have been lost, you know, to the sands of time that then get rediscovered in the most bizarre of circumstances. Or there are moments where there are actual rumors of works of art out there that just haven't been seen but have been known to have been created. So, for example, the first thing that comes to mind is that there's a fact of the matter is that Leonardo da Vinci created this amazing wall painting in a palazzo in Florence, but then it got painted over, and that there was also a similar program going on at the same time with Michelangelo. And so even though you cannot actually go in and see these paintings that are on the walls today, scientists and art historians have been coming together for years, assuming that they are going to be able to find it once the technology becomes a little bit better, and that you're not going to, you know, tear down a wall, for example, or damage any painting or fresco that might be buried underneath. So there are these elements that feel like maybe they're part of a book or a movie, but they do actually have some play there. I also think that in some ways, stories like Dan Brown's is really actually good for art. They might be a little too conspiracy theory, or maybe they might be a little too hard to believe. But in some ways, I think that if those are the kind of stories that get people interested in learning about art further, then why not? Why not go for it?
How has technology changed art history? You mentioned tech in your answer. I'm curious about that.
Yeah, I think a lot of it comes down to being able to better not only find the works of art, but better care for works of art. A lot has been done in the past 20 or 30 years about art conservation and being able to properly restore works of art. Of course, there have been mishaps along the way. I think a lot of people remember a few years back when there was the incredibly terrible renovation of a painting in the south of Spain that went horribly awry, and people started calling it Beast Jesus or Monkey Jesus. So that's one of those moments when the technology doesn't really help things, but I think those are very rare examples. Now there's so many more opportunities to be so painstaking and careful with being able to try to get a work of art as close to how it was meant to look by the artist as possible. So in lots of ways, I think it's a really wonderful thing. And the fact that we now have amazing systems like Google Arts and Culture and visual tours, especially right now in the age of COVID, when we can't necessarily go and spend a ton of time at museums as much as we would like, it's pretty amazing that we can just go onto our computers and go see some of the greatest works of art in the world without having to leave our homes.
Before we leave conspiracy theories, are there any theories or secret messages or codes that you think are plausible? Any stories that you've heard that you think, maybe?
Totally. You know, I started writing this book and began the podcast a couple of years ago, totally based on a conspiracy theory that was told to me directly by one of my professors. And that was that when I was in my basic Art History 101 class, my professor was talking about the Mona Lisa, and right before she stopped telling us what was so great about the painting and why it was important, she said, oh, you know, you can go to the Louvre and you can see it in Paris if you get the chance to travel there someday. And then she sort of paused and said, but if you don't, it's no big deal, because the Mona Lisa on view at the Louvre is fake. And for just about a minute or so, she said, oh, it was stolen. It was stolen multiple times. And the first time it was stolen by known forgers. But it was such an odd statement. It seemed like a complete conspiracy theory from a professor who seemed very controlled and not inclined to those kind of theories, that it really stuck with me. And all these years later, I just wanted to know more. And it's been interesting to really delve into the story of the Mona Lisa, of these possible multiple thefts of her, and why some people think that there might be multiple copies spinning around the world.
So is it fake?
I think it's hard to tell. We will probably never know. I think as a curator myself, as the North Carolina Museum of Art, I personally think that part of what is important about a work of art is having it be on view. That's part of what gives it its value and its pricelessness. So I'm inclined to believe that, yes, it's incredibly important, and yes, it's real. But at the same time, there is that side of me that says, well, you know, it is literally priceless. You cannot put a price on how much the Mona Lisa personally, one painting, is. So I could see why you might want to believe that it could be fake. You'd want to store the real one away in a vault if you could. So that's another kind of hedging my bets. But if I had to go on the record, then I would say I think that's still the real deal.
My guest is Jennifer Dassel. The name of her book is Art Curious, Stories of the Unexpected, Slightly Odd, and Strangely Wonderful Art History. So you break the book into three categories: the unexpected, the slightly odd, and the strangely wonderful. So let's start with something from the unexpected. You tell a story about the connection between Jackson Pollock, abstract expressionism, and the CIA. And this is all about the Cold War and a failed art show called Advancing American Art. That one was a failure. So why did the CIA become attracted to the work of Pollock and others when their first attempt to sort of spread America around the world through art failed?
This was such an interesting story to me, and it was news to me too when I actually started learning about this. So back during the Cold War, the idea was that we wanted to put out this message that Americans were free in every aspect of life, and that included being free to express oneself in any way, shape, or form without any agenda. And if you wanted to draw a black square on a wall and have it mean nothing, but that's a square, then that was fine. And that was something that was really at odds with the Soviet thinking, in which their style of painting, which was called Soviet realism, was very much about propaganda and putting forth the idealized look at what life in the USSR would be. So to have a painting that is like a Jackson Pollock, just all paint squiggles on the wall, that was deemed really subversive in comparison. So the CIA covertly backed arts organizations, a lot of people who were connected to MoMA especially, and asked them to promote a series of exhibitions that traveled around the world, especially to countries that were considered to be on the fence somewhat between communism and capitalism, and really promoted this as a visual example about the things that made America great. And this really happened. This is one of those things that sounds like a complete fabrication, but it was a real story. And the tales of this were declassified in the 80s and 90s, and that was the only point at which this really moved forward. And it explains some really interesting things about the fact that abstract expressionism as an art movement really catapulted into popularity very quickly. So a lot of people have questioned whether or not abstract expressionism and people like Jackson Pollock and Mark Rothko and Helen Frankenthaler, whether they would have found that level of success so quickly, especially from organizations like the Met, who collected Pollock only a year or so after he died, which was considered rather forward-thinking for an institution that didn't do a whole lot of contemporary collecting up to that point. So it's a really interesting question. I think personally that the abstract expressionists would have garnered major success regardless, because they were such rule breakers that really changed the game of art. But it is a good question to know that did the CIA really cause them to explode like that?
My guest is Jennifer Dassel. The name of her book is Art Curious, Stories of the Unexpected, Slightly Odd, and Strangely Wonderful in Art History. We'll have more after the break, including, was Jack the Ripper a great artist? That's next. This is All of It. My guest is Jennifer Dassel, author of Art Curious, Stories of the Unexpected, Slightly Odd, and Strangely Wonderful in Art History. She is an associate curator at the Contemporary Art North Carolina Museum of Art, and she hosts a podcast of the same name, Art Curious. All right, I teased our audience about Jack the Ripper. This is one of these sort of infamous slash famous conspiracy theories. It's famous because a few years back, the superstar crime writer Patricia Cornwell claimed that she had solved the Jack the Ripper case and that Jack the Ripper was actually an artist. who do people like Patricia Cornwell think Jack the Ripper was?
A lot of people point to one person in particular, and that's Walter Sickert, who was a British painter who many say is one of the best British painters of the late 19th and early 20th century. And it's become such a huge deal within the Ripper community, apparently, that's what they call them, the Ripperologists, that it's become this really flashpoint where some people are really arguing pro Sickert, and other people are saying there is no way he was Jack the Ripper. And in the process of Patricia Cornwell going through and trying to figure this out, she has actually become one of the biggest collectors of Sickert's work in the world. So she's inadvertently supporting him as an artist while she's still trying to prove that he was indeed this super famous serial killer.
What's the evidence? Why do people think this?
You know, it's really interesting. A lot of the evidence, I have to say, is very circumstantial in terms of these small comparisons that can be made. But she has gone through with just a host of scientists and historians, art historians, gallery people and museum curators, and has gone through and has done not only close looks at the kind of letters that are known to have been possible actual letters from Jack the Ripper. There have been a lot of fakes over the years, but there are several that have been ID'd as probably from the real guy himself. And they've gone through and have analyzed not only the kind of paper that seems to match up between the small run of paper that both Sickert and the Ripper were supposed to have had together at the same time period, and that the Ripper apparently made these small doodles in the margins and would often draw little sketches in these sort of taunting letters that he would present to the police. And so it's small things like that. She also would go through and analyze paintings the way that we often do as art historians to find little messages or details that seem like they might be very comparable. So, for example, there's a number of paintings that are very dark and kind of edgy of nudes that look like they've been slashed across the face or the body, so that there have been comparisons made between the crime scene photographs of the canonical five, the five Ripper victims that we know by name, and have compared them to the figures in Sickert's paintings. But the big one is that about 10, 15 years ago, she published that she was having DNA work done on Ripper belongings, Ripper letters, and also some of the work and items that were housed by Walter Sickert himself to see if there was a connection. And she actually claimed that there was. And obviously, that's a huge deal to be able to use this science backing to be able to identify the possible identity of Jack the Ripper. But then she had to come back and release that it wasn't DNA the way that we think of DNA during any other crime scene investigation that helps to highlight potential murders or, you know, fatherhoods, for example, but that it was a special kind of DNA called mitochondrial DNA that is less precise. And it's, I'm thinking about it in terms of like blood typing, where it helps to narrow down a segment of the population, but it doesn't rule out everyone. So thinking about this as a numbers game, it really would narrow down the population of turn of the century London to within a few million people, but that still might include Walter Sickert within there. But it also says that there are already, you know, 900,000 other people who might fit the bill. So there's nothing direct that can really point to him as Jack the Ripper. So I think it's one of those things, again, with it's similar to the Mona Lisa story, where we don't have enough evidence to really go forward and say whether or not he is. But at the same time, he is one of the best suspects that we have currently.
You also dedicate a chapter to a controversial work by Leonardo, or maybe not. It's the story of the painting Salvatore Mundi, known as The Last Leonardo. In 2017, the painting was sold at auction for $450.3 million. At that time, the most expensive work ever sold at auction, and allegedly purchased by Mohammed bin Salman. So first of all, what in this painting seems consistent with a Da Vinci and what seems off?
I think there's so much that just at first glance, when I remember very seriously sitting at my desk at the museum and looking at the first images that were coming up and announcing the sale, and I thought, that just looks off to me. There's this blurriness that's part of the painting's surface that might be just because of a botched restoration or conservation efforts. And we know that there were many that were done over the years, even far before the 20th century. But there's this look that is so imprecise. It just doesn't look the way that a Leonardo usually looks. A lot of people are also pointing to the orb that Christ is holding in that Salvatore Mundi painting, which is thought to be, you know, an example of the world, this clear crystalline orb. And the optics of it, it's the things like the reflections and the refraction of light going through it, it isn't scientifically accurate the way that we know that Leonardo, who was this incredible polymath who knew a lot about the way that the world works and science and about light refraction and so forth, that people are saying, scientists and art historians both are saying, that just doesn't look like someone who understands the way that light would actually pass through a glass orb. At the same time, there's this beautiful texture to the curls of Jesus's hair in the picture that are so exquisite that you can just tell that someone really knew how to wield a paintbrush in a way to make it look so believably lifelike. So art historians seem to be very mixed about whether or not it is a real Leonardo. And there's a wonderful quote from a critic who said that if this was a real Leonardo, it's been very unlucky. And if it's not a real Leonardo, it's been an extremely lucky painting to have sold for this incredible price. And so I think it's still a big question. And it's been very odd that it disappeared from view and it was trumpeted as being this prize purchase that was going to be shown at the Louvre in Dubai, and then, the Louvre Abu Dhabi. And then it disappeared from view, and we have had little hints about where it may be. And I think the last thing we've heard is that it was possibly on Mohammed bin Salman's yacht about a year ago. And so we're still kind of waiting for it to surface again, but I sure hope it shows up. I personally would love to see it in person.
If anybody wants to see the image we're talking about, you could head to our website at allofitwnyc. My guest is Jennifer Dessel. The name of her book is Art Curious. Before we go, I do want to talk about Norman Rockwell for a moment, sort of the woke Norman Rockwell, because, you know, he's known yes. for sort of charming sentimental paintings, A Small Town America. But later on in his career, he became social justice oriented. A lot of us know the painting, The Problem We All Live With, of Ruby Bridges walking to the all-white school, accompanied by U.S. Marshals. But you focus in on a painting called Murder in Mississippi. Would you describe this for us? And what's striking about his political work?
Yes, I think it's so interesting. Murder in Mississippi doesn't have that same sense of Rockwellianness the way that the painting of Ruby Bridges does, because Rockwell, we think so much of like little dimpled girls and Boy Scouts, and again, that real Americana sense that you're discussing. And so with Ruby Bridges, we still get that, in that she is this adorable little girl and she still has those perfect pleats of her dress. It's very Rockwellian in that sense. But Murder in Mississippi, there is nothing charming going on there. There is nothing beautiful or adorable. And it is a picture of three men who were core workers. So these were social justice workers in the 1960s who were in Mississippi working for voter registration for black voters in the late 60s. And they were brutally killed by Ku Klux Klan crusaders, I suppose, on their end. And this painting is so dark. It's almost entirely black and white, except for a couple smears of very bright red blood, blood tones. And all you see are these three individuals. One is black and the other two are white. One man is collapsed on the ground. And we can't tell necessarily if he is dead yet, but we know that he will be. This is a nonfiction painting, I suppose you can say. And the third and second people are kind of grasping each other. One man is holding the other up, and we know that they are meeting their fate at that moment, and all we see of their killers are some very ominous shadows, and it looks like they are caught in the lights of headlights of vehicles that are shining on them. It is disturbing, and it's still done with that insane Norman Rockwell precision. It just is so wonderful, amazing the way that the illustrator and painter, he was able to hide his brush strokes so that it has almost that photographic sense. And for me, it's that combination, that very precision of Rockwell that we know so well, with this stark, terrible moment in history that he documented on painting, that is the disconnect for me. We don't think about him creating works like this. We think about them still having that sheen of something wonderful.
How were these works received?
I think in the beginning, I think it was a shock. And a lot of this is partially because Rockwell had at this point made a major decision in which he left the Saturday Evening Post, where he was at for upwards of about 50 years, and really developed almost the entirety of his career and his artistic style working with the Post. And he left in the 60s because he was feeling very hemmed in, predominantly because of the racial injustice that was going on with the civil rights movement. And the Saturday Evening Post didn't allow images of African Americans or other individuals unless they were in what they deemed a subservient manner. And Rockwell, on his marriage to his third wife, who was far progressive, really started understanding that that was not a good, that was not a good look, as we say today, and that he really wanted to make more of a change and show more of what America really looked like and what he was experiencing as someone who was turning more towards this social justice aspect. So he moved on to Life magazine and, Look magazine. And at that point, it was all about the image. And so he was creating illustrations that were meant to really be at the forefront of every magazine article. And this was where Murder in Mississippi showed up. And as in general, it showed up very well. It was received as this hallmark of social justice. And I think it's really stood the test of time.
The name of the book is Art Curious, Stories of the Unexpected, Slightly Odd, and Strangely Wonderful in Art History. It is by Jennifer Dassel. Jennifer, thank you so much for being with us.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics Pre-Alcohol Probiotic Drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at ZBiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's ZBiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.